Hey everyone, this is Tim Harris. I'm the pastor of Woodburn Baptist Church, and this is our weekly podcast. Hope it encourages you. Hope it makes you want to be closer to Jesus and more like Him. Hope you enjoy this sermon. And if you want to know more about us, find us online at woodburnbaptist.org. Good morning, everybody. Y'all good? It is the most beautiful Sunday morning ever. Why are we in here? We should be having church outside. We waited all year for this. Let's just do this in here, then y'all get out of here and go enjoy sunshine today. Romans chapter 1. My name is Tim Harris. I am pastor here at Woodburn Baptist Church. I am so glad that you're here with me. I lost my sermon notes somewhere in the 8 o'clock service. Don't know how that happened. That's either a really good sign or a bad sign of what's about to come here. Romans chapter 1 is where we are. We've started a new sermon series going verse by verse through the book of Romans, and that brings us to today, verse 18. So Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, through the end of that chapter. Paul is writing Romans in many ways to address a real issue, real questions in the church, and most of those questions have to do with salvation. And so Paul, in the book of Romans, just lays out one of the clearest, most beautiful articulations of God's plan of salvation, the plan for saving us. Of course, the question in the early church comes down to the problem of Jews and Gentiles in the same church. You got the Jews who had Moses and the prophets and the law, and they had God tabernacling in their midst. They just always known God and God's ways. So it seems that they have a tremendous advantage, which they do. The Gentiles, which is pretty much most of the world, we had none of that. We didn't have the prophets. We didn't have the law. We didn't have God tabernacling in our midst. And so you have this dilemma. There's one plan of salvation, one sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. It's Jesus. But that raises the question, how can one plan of salvation cover both the Jews and the Gentiles? They have such a different role in salvation history. And so Paul is laying out that case. I'm giving you all this so what we read today, you'll put in a larger context. Paul is trying to answer the question of how everybody gets saved the same way. And the short answer, everybody gets saved the same way because everybody's got the same problem, and that problem is sin. It's all sin. It's always sin. Everything comes down to sin. So to understand Jesus' saving message, you have to understand why you need saving in the first place. And you need saving in the first place because you're a sinner. We all sin. Now, Paul is saying that. Now, he's going to take some time to really build that argument. He's really going to say it in chapter 3. Romans 3:23 says, everybody sins, for all have sinned. We all fall short of God's glorious standard. That's Romans 3:23. So in Romans 3, Paul's going to say, we all sin. But he's going to get us there. So Romans chapter 1, what we're about to read, is Paul explaining sin from a Gentile perspective. Gentiles sin. If y'all don't know it, you haven't been to Logan County. Gentiles sin, right? And then chapter 2, Jews sin too. So in chapter 2, it's Jews sin. So sin from a Gentile perspective, sin from a Jewish perspective, you get it? So Gentiles sin and Jews sin. And in chapter 3, we all sin. So that's the point. We all sin. We all have the same problem. And for that reason, we're all saved in the very same way. And that is the mercy and the love of Jesus. So Romans chapter 1, verse 18. I want us to pick up right here. And we're talking about now how it is that Gentiles who don't have the law and don't have the background of the Jews, how they still have no excuse as sinners. So here we go. In many ways, this is all of our story. So let's read it together. Romans chapter 1. Starting in verse 18. Y'all there? Did I talk long enough to y'all to find it? Romans 1:18. Let's read this together. But God shows his anger from heaven against all sinful, wicked people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. They know the truth about God because he made it obvious to them. For ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, so they have no excuse for not knowing God. Yeah, they knew God, but they wouldn't worship him as God or even give him thanks. And they began to think up foolish ideas of what God was like, and as a result, their minds became dark and confused. claiming to be wise, they became fools. And instead of worshiping the glorious, ever-living God, they worshiped idols made to look like mere people and birds and animals and reptiles. So God abandoned them to do whatever shameful things their hearts desire. As a result, they did vile and degrading things with each other's bodies. They traded the truth about God for a lie. So they worshiped and served the things God created instead of the Creator himself, who is worthy of eternal praise. Amen. That is why God abandoned them to their shameful desires. Even the women turned against the natural way to have sex and instead indulged in sex with each other. And the men, instead of having normal sexual relations with women, burned with lust for each other. Men did shameful things with other men, and as a result of this sin, they suffered within themselves the penalty they deserved. Since they thought it foolish to acknowledge God, he abandoned them to their foolish thinking and let them do things that should never be done. Their lives became full of every kind of wickedness, sin, greed, hate, envy, murder, quarreling, deception, malicious behavior, and gossip. They're backstabbers, haters of God, insolent, proud, boastful. They invent new ways of sinning, and they disobey their parents, refuse to understand, break their promises, are heartless, have no mercy. They know God's justice requires that those who do these things deserve to die, yet they do them anyway. Worse yet, they encourage others to do them too. Let's talk about sin, y'all. What'd you do Monday? Did you see it? What happened on Monday? Eclipse. Yeah, who saw it? Who watched it? Yeah. Who bought the $2.99 glasses from IGA to watch them? That's what I did. Yeah, I bought them at IGA. Because you're not supposed to stare at the sun, apparently, with the naked eye, if you learned that the hard way. So it's Monday, the eclipse is coming. Y'all know me, that's my thing, y'all. That just lights me up. The total eclipse was here for us about 7 years ago, and that was amazing. That was once in a lifetime kind of thing. But now Monday was just kind of icing on the cake, a partial eclipse, but it was almost total, not totally, but it was a good eclipse, you gotta admit. It was awesome. I still got stuff to do though. Eclipse doesn't last all day, so I still had to get about my business. So I was actually at Meijer's grocery store when the eclipse started. So I just stopped. I got out of my car. I put on my IGA glasses, like all the cool people did, and stood there and just looking at the eclipse. It was amazing. It was already started. It was cool. So I'm just standing there in Meijer's parking lot, you know. So all of a sudden, this guy comes up. He comes in so hot, puts a parking place next to me. He jumps out of his car. He's got like six pairs of sunglasses on. I'm not kidding. Just sunglasses stacked on his face. And he said, Is it started? I said, it started. And so he stood there. And y'all, I know six pairs of sunglasses sounds like a lot, but it ain't. And he was staring at the sun and his eyes were watering. And I'm just thinking, dude, man, you gotta stop. We stood there the longest time. It was the coolest thing. Did you see it? I mean, you know. An eclipse happens, of course, as you know, when the moon passes between the earth and the sun. Now, when you look up in the sky, the sun and the moon look exactly the same size. And I mean exactly. Because they are exactly the same size. The full moon and the sun in the sky are exactly the same size, but they're not the same size. The sun is actually 400 times larger than the moon. Y'all know this, right? 400 times larger than the moon, but as it turns out, the sun is exactly 400 times further away. Let that sink in. It's 400 times larger, but 400 times further away. So for that reason, they appear in our sky exactly the same size. And that makes an eclipse possible. That moon passes in front of the sun and they are exactly the same size. And it just becomes like you punched them out of the same piece of paper and one blocks the other. You can see the amazing beams of the sun coming around that moon. And they say that's we've learned more in those moments of discovery during an eclipse than any other time because you can't stare and study at the sun any other time. It's just the most amazing thing. exactly 400 times bigger and 400 times further away. Do you not understand the elegance of creation, of the universe? I mean, you understand that? How everything is so perfectly designed and calibrated. I love science, and I could nerd out any time with you on science. But I don't believe for a moment that any of this is accidental or random. You think it's random that the sun is exactly 400 times larger and also 400 times further away? I mean, it is evidence of an intelligence, a designer who made things and made things with us in mind. I mean, even scientists will tell you that the conditions in the universe seem exactly measured in order to create life. And the universe itself, so perfectly, wonderfully made and calibrated, not only for life, but for observation. Scientists say that if you wanted to find the most optimal location for studying the universe, you'd probably pick our location, like the Earth's location in our solar system, and also our solar system's location in our constellation, you know, in our galaxy, and on it goes. We are in the Milky Way galaxy, approximate center. It's just amazing. If we were any other place, we couldn't even see out, you know. I'm just calling your attention to this, the way that the world itself, that creation itself has fingerprints of the maker all over it, because this is important for Paul in Romans chapter 1. It is true that the Gentiles, that all of us who weren't, you know, Old Testament people, we didn't have Moses and we didn't have the law. We didn't have the prophets. We didn't have God tabernacling with his people. And so for that reason, you think, well, what are we supposed to know about God? And Paul actually comes out and says, well, a lot, or at least enough. Creation reveals enough of God to make believers of us all. That's what Paul would say. You can look at creation and know something. You won't know everything, but you can know something about God's eternal power and God's divine nature. Creation itself bears a kind of witness to the Creator. Everything has his magnificent fingerprints. This is what Paul says. And I think you'd have to admit it. You can't look at a sunrise. You can't look under a microscope. You ever taken a drop of pond water and looked at it under a microscope? There is an entire universe of microscopic creatures in every puddle. It is amazing what God has made, and all of it sings his praises. Paul says creation reveals enough of God to make believers of us all. However, we choose unbelief and turn away from our maker with no excuse, Paul would say. You know enough, you don't know everything, but you know enough to praise and worship God, but you don't, and this is how Gentiles come into sin. We know better, but we do otherwise. In this chapter, in this chapter here, Paul uses the same word, and it gets lost in your English translation, but it's the word for trade or exchange. It's a Greek word. It means to trade or exchange. And Paul keeps using it. There's a pattern of that word in this chapter. First off, it's in verse 23. My New Living Translation doesn't use the word. It's the idea, but you can see it. Verse 23. Instead of worshiping the glorious ever-living God, they worshiped idols made to look like people, birds, animals. In other words, what Paul says is they exchanged. They traded the worship of the ever-living God for idols made to look like people and birds and reptiles and dumb stuff. You know, it's that idea. Paul uses that word for exchange. They exchange worship of a true God for the little gods that we make for ourselves. We exchange worship of God for worship of idols. And then verse 25, we exchange, we trade the truth that we know about God for lies. So we exchange the truth for lies. So notice this pattern, which takes us right to verse 26. And the women exchange the natural way to have sex with men for sex with each other. Notice that exchange. It's a pattern through Paul's argument here. This is the Gentile way of thinking and falling into sin. It has to do with this exchange. We can see from what God has made some of what God would expect of us, and yet we turn away from that every single time. Now, verse 18 sets us up for a passage about God's wrath, God's anger. That's how he begins. God shows his anger from heaven against wicked people. So you're expecting a passage about wrath, and actually that's what you got. You just missed the wrath part. Because it's probably not what you were expecting. And when it says God's going to show wrath against wicked people, man, I expected a lightning bolt. You know, I wanted lightning to flash and just, you know, fry them into crispy critters in the spot, you know. I mean, you know, give us some wrath here, God. And you want to see them break out with boils, you know, but that's not what happens. It's the other word that Paul repeats over and over in this passage. Notice the pattern there. Look at verse 24. So God abandoned them. Notice how many times this word is used. God abandoned them. It doesn't mean God abandoned us. God's never going to leave or forsake you. We're not talking about that he leaves you alone. That's not what he's saying. Instead, God abandoned them to do whatever shameful things their hearts desire. Verse 26, God abandoned them to their shameful desires. So understand something about God's wrath. God's wrath isn't necessarily a lightning bolt that, you know, kills you on the spot. It could be, but that's not normally how we experience his wrath. God's wrath takes the form of his letting us live fully in the darkness and confusion we've chosen. He just lets us have what we were asking for. And that's wrath. Now, it's the story of the prodigal son who comes into his father and says, man, I can't take it anymore. I want out of here. And the father just lets him go. Now, letting him go is the worst possible thing for him, but the father understands you can't make a person stay who doesn't want to stay. And so God's wrath takes this form of just letting the prodigal son, the prodigal daughter, let them go. You want sin? You're going to have sin. You're going to have what you've chosen. But now understand, sin has consequences. And you can choose to sin, but you can't choose your consequences. And so they make this trade, they make this exchange, they exchange truth for a lie, they exchange the way of God for sin, and they're just choosing this, so they get this, but then they get all this. But understand, they weren't asking for all this, they just wanted this. And that's the nature of sin. You know, don't really ask for everything that goes along with it, but that's the thing. We don't always see everything that goes along with it. We don't even always know what we're asking for. But we demand it. And God gives us this tremendous, terrible freedom and lets us do sometimes exactly what we choose. And this is what Romans 1 is about. This is how sin operates. So God lets us go our way, and that's exactly what happens. Now understand, in these verses, Paul is giving this very, very complete picture of the entire human family. All of us, sinful as we are, and it includes everybody. Remember, I said we're going toward Romans chapter 3, everybody sins, all sin. So Romans chapter 1 is giving this first family portrait of the Gentiles of the world and the way in which we turn from our Maker, and it includes us all. Notice the climax. Notice where Paul leads. He goes to this terrible list of sins at the very end of chapter 1. I mean, it's all there. It's all there. I'm not surprised at all that he starts off with murder. Murder's one of the top on the list, and you know, we all agree with that. Man, we may not be perfect, but we ain't killed nobody today. I mean, you know, that's how we are. Murder's the worst in everybody's mind, and I'm not surprised that Paul's got murder right there, but the problem is, I read that list, and we go from murder real quickly to some really everyday things. And that's where it feels funny that Paul's still talking about sin when he gets a little closer to, you know, the everyday stuff that you and I do, like greed. Like, he's got greed right there. Y'all, I mean, our culture celebrates greed. I mean, most of us in some way, man, we agree, we love money. Man, take a look in that church parking lot. There is not a jalopy out there, y'all. We love stuff. We love money. And it doesn't seem odd to us because everybody around us is greedy. It's on the list, y'all. Greed. You know, not one time has anybody in church ever said, Pastor Jim, I'm coming out of the closet. I'm going to come out. I'm going to have to let everybody know I'm greedy. You know, I've embraced the greed lifestyle, you know, which most of us have. Hate, envy, murder. Look at this list. Gossip. Gossip. I mean, if there's ever a sin, like church people's favorite sin, it's got to be gossip, y'all. It's poison. It's terrible. But man, some of us are Olympic, you know, gold medal winners here. And we don't think anything of it. Well, you know, it's just, you know, talk. It's amazing the way Paul goes through this list. The end of verse 30, disobey their parents. Like that's on the list of terrible sins. Disobey their parents. I disobeyed my parents every day. I mean, I'm not proud of it. I mean, don't tell my dad, but I mean, you know, I mean, who didn't miss 11 o'clock curfew? I mean, disobey their parents? I mean, I've seen those kids in the hall. They're terrible. I mean, you know, I mean, not your kids, other people's kids. Your kids are sweet. Y'all understand what I'm saying? Look at verse 31. They break their promises. Oh, my goodness. Like, that is a terrible sin, to break promises. You told your girlfriend you pick her up at 6, but you picked her up at 6:45 because, you know, you had a lot of stuff going on. I mean, you broke a promise, but doesn't everybody? They know God's justice requires that those who do these things deserve to die. What? Are we talking about sin like that? Because that is everyday behavior for all of us. And do you understand? That's Paul's point. We don't all sin the same, but we all sin. And we have this terrible, tragic habit of excusing the sins we're guilty of and then laying it on the people who are guilty of sins we don't consider ourselves guilty of. And Paul doesn't leave us room to do that. Which brings me to the whole issue of same-sex relations that Paul mentions in this passage. Some of you are like, Pastor Tim, I can't believe you. You went right past the gay part. You know, like you couldn't wait for that. Or some of you are wishing we would not do this. I said we go verse by verse of the book of Romans, so we're going to go verse by verse of the book of Romans, and it leads us to this place. Can we talk about same-sex relations? The Bible does. Can we? There was a woman, we'll call her Cindy. Cindy and her husband had one child, one son. He's a great kid. He was her only child, and he was their pride and joy. Loved this boy. Everybody loved this boy. This is a church family, not our church. This is not a family from our church. But they were a church family, and their son was just that kid. He grew up in church every time the door was open, and he loved it. On Youth Sunday, he preached and sang because he could do it all, and everybody loved this boy. He was the church's, you know, golden boy. It's his parents' golden boy. Kid loved Jesus and loved his parents, and one night he walked into the living room, and he tears, and he said, Mom and Dad, I need to tell you all something. And that night, their 15-year-old son told his parents that he was gay. Cindy said that she tried to just hold it all together herself because she was just falling apart, but she didn't want to handle this moment wrong for her son. She didn't know what any of this meant, but she wanted him to know that this was a conversation they could have, and so she stayed in there with him. And then when the son went to bed, the parents stayed up and they talked, and they did this for weeks. They didn't sleep for weeks. They just stayed awake at night and they talked. They were trying to figure out what they had done wrong, or they were trying to find a way to say he's not gay. He's in the wrong crowd at school. He's with the wrong, or he's seen some things on the internet, and we shouldn't have let him have that kind of freedom. Now he's confused. I mean, they went through all of these mental gymnastics trying to tell themselves that this isn't true, this can't be true. And they didn't talk to anybody. Because who do you talk to I mean, who are they going to talk to? So finally, Cindy came to her pastor in pieces. And she told her pastor, she said, when our son told us that he was gay, my first thought was fear. Because I know, and this is the mama talking, she said, I know how unkind the world is going to be to him. I just hate that that could be his life. I hate how unkind the world will be. And then she said, but my biggest fear is I know when the church finds out, they will never see him the same. And that's not a story from our church, I promise. But can I also just say, y'all know that's a story from our church, right? I mean, it's not a personal story, but that happens here. We don't talk about it. In being your pastor for 27 years, I've learned some things about y'all, and I've learned one thing, two things, whatever. There are two things y'all don't mention, like at prayer time or taking prayer requests. There are two things off limits. First, if you got a family member in jail, you won't tell us. I'm telling you, I don't know what that is exactly, but if you got a brother or a son or a mama in jail, you never tell us. Like, nobody ever has raised their hand and said, y'all pray, my mama's in the pokey. You know, would y'all just please pray? Y'all don't. You don't. I visit the jail on occasion, so I see them. And so I know, and I often find out, but you don't want me to say it at church, and you don't want anybody to know, and I've learned that about you. We don't talk about people who go to jail. And we don't pray for them, not out loud. We don't share that. You don't want people to know that your family's that janked up. I get it. We also don't talk about gay family members. We don't surely talk about our own sexual disorientation. Nobody's likely to talk about their feelings of same-sex attraction. That just is not something that we seem to permit here. And the fact that it's off limits for conversation means we don't know. So you feel really alone in this? You think you're the only mama with a gay son? And you're not. But you'll never know. Because all the mamas and daddies with gay sons and daughters, this is not the place. Can I just say, we've got to do a better job of representing Christ with one another. We've got to do a better job. Because if we can't walk through these things together, if we can't do that here, then we're just leaving each other to the world. If my son were to come to me and say that he is gay, and I can't bring him to church after that, then that just means I'm leaving him to the world. There was a mama from our church who came to me because she knew that I knew that her son was gay. She came to me in tears with one question, and it was just, are you going to throw him out of the church? She loves her son. She loves him, and she wants him to know Jesus. She wants him to find a way to walk through all of this, and she knows he needs the church. Where's he going to go? Who's going to listen to his story? Who's going to help him make sense of everything he's thinking and feeling? Who's going to show him the way of Christ if the church shuts the door in his face? We have to do a better job. We have to do a better job. Now, part of doing a better job is always speaking the truth and telling each other the truth. And so I want to remind you the truth. Romans chapter 1, Paul is trying to emphasize that there are things that are just set in place. It's the order of creation. When Paul is speaking in Romans chapter 1, he's taking you back to Genesis. But back to creation, the God who made it all, the God who, just looking at the things he has made, you can know about his eternal power and his divine nature. And so even without knowing much else, you can learn some things from creation. And these are things that don't change, and you can't trade them for other newer ideas. And so let's just go straight to it. Paul is reflecting here a biblical sexual ethic that goes all the way back to Genesis. And simply put, it's just sex is a good gift. And the church has to affirm this. We have to be able to say that sex is good and that it was God's idea. And it's a good gift. I mean, I know y'all are so awkward right now because I keep saying the word sex. And some of you are thinking, stop saying sex. My kids are sitting right here. And I'm thinking, your kids are in college. Yeah, I mean, you know. And y'all know that's not even a joke. I mean, something like, it's so awkward because you're sitting by your adult son and just like, stop saying sex, you know? Or others of you are like, you know, Pastor, you're saying sex and we're going to have so many questions in the car on the way home now. And I'm just saying good. Good. It should be a conversation that you can have. And if the first time your kid heard the word sex was at church, I think that's great. That means we win. But are you really silly enough to think they haven't heard it? I mean, are they not living in the same world I'm in? I mean, we live in the most pornified, sexualized culture in history. I want your children to understand that we know about these things and that we have something to say. If we never talk about sexual things, our kids assume we don't know anything about sexual things. Not that looking across this crowd, I can't tell that y'all are really sexy, but I promise you, your kids don't see that. They don't think we know about any of it, and that's why we have to make this a topic of healthy Christian conversation, and we have to let that be a regular, normal thing so that it's not awkward when we really have to have a hard conversation about sexual things. You with me? Sex is a good gift. It's to be celebrated. It's God's idea. It's amazing. It's given by God with boundaries. Like everything else, when God gives it to us, it's perfectly calibrated and designed to bless us. So when God gives rules or boundaries, moral boundaries for us, it's not to take the fun out of things for us. It is rather to help us understand how these good gifts are meant to be enjoyed and celebrated. So sex is a good gift given by God to be shared between one woman and one man wed for life. That's just it. Sex has one place. It belongs in marriage between a man and a woman. All the way back to Genesis. Now, I could take you back to Genesis, but just to get a double win here, I'm going to take you to Matthew, where Jesus quotes Genesis. You know, boom, boom. Jesus quotes Genesis, and Jesus is talking about sexuality and marriage. And Jesus is taking us back to design, what the Creator intended. So you with me? These are the words of Jesus. Matthew chapter 19, verses 4 and 5. Jesus says, haven't you read the scriptures? And let me just point out, if you're in a conversation with Jesus and Jesus says to you, have you not read the Bible? This isn't going well for you, you know? Jesus says, haven't you read the scriptures? They record that from the beginning, Jesus is quoting Genesis now, from the beginning, God made them male and female. This is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, joins his wife, and the two are united into one. The word there, the literal language there is the two become one flesh. One flesh. I love that. It is a sexual picture, but it's also a biblical picture of what God has designed us for. The one flesh language is important because in Genesis, remember, when God brings Eve to Adam, Adam bursts forth in the world's first love song. He just bursts forth singing. He says, at last, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. I love that. And Genesis goes on. Adam says, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. And Genesis says, and this is why a man leaves his father and mother, clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh, you see, flesh of my flesh. But I don't want you to miss the male and female part because in our day and age, there are people who want to try and blur these lines that cannot be blurred. Now, I'm not in any way speaking hatefully toward people. That's not even in my heart. But I want to speak biblically. This is what the Bible says, and it hasn't changed for thousands of years, and it's not going to change for you now. God created us male and female. There's a binary nature to human identity and marriage, and that cannot be exchanged. It can't be traded for something newer or something that for some reason seems to fit our culture better. You know, between just any two consenting adults. Consent is not the biblical ethic. This is the biblical ethic, and it comes back to the binary, male and female. It's in the very fabric of creation. Go back to the book of Genesis. I assume you're familiar somewhat with Genesis chapter 1 and the way that God created the heavens and the earth, but go back and think about that story and how it moves. The scripture begins, God said there was light, and God separates the light from the darkness. That's a binary. And then that story continues to move in these binary relations. There's light and there's darkness. And God separates the land from the ocean, the water. And then God says there was morning and there was evening. There was day and there was night. These binary relations continue all the way up to the creation of the human beings when God creates them in his own image, male and female. You see, that binary relation is in the very fabric of creation, and it's not an accident, and it's not something we can just erase now. It's important. It's important because Jesus and Genesis go on to say, this is why. This binary relationship, the maleness and the femaleness, it's a part of all of us. This is why a man leaves his father and mother. I mean, this explains why. This isn't some interesting feature. This is why. This is foundational. And so there is this important biblical notion of sexuality and how it is to be expressed and how it is to be enjoyed and celebrated. And it is always, always inside the relationship of one man and one woman wed for life. Now, I know that sounds narrow from our, you know, extremely sexually inventive culture, but anything outside those boundaries is sin. Anything outside those boundaries is sin. So pornography is sin. If you're single and not married, that means that you do not have sexual partners. You don't have a sexual life in that regard. You are to live your life in sexual fidelity and integrity until that time when you're joined with the opposite sex spouse in marriage. If you're single, you don't have sex. Well, Pastor Tim, what if we're living together? What? Do you think that somehow makes you an exception? Oh, but Pastor Tim, we live together because it's such a good financial decision. It may be an excellent financial decision. It's also sin. I'm not being harsh. I'm just saying that this is the word of God. This is the design of the God who made you. And you can think that you're being creative and monkeying around and somehow improving, but you're not doing anything other than just exchanging the truth for something else that appeals to you. Now, in this whole category, any sex relations that regard same sex, obviously that is sin. It just is. When Scripture talks about homosexual acts, they're always forbidden. They just are. And I say that because if you pay attention to the conversation these days, there are a whole lot of people who are trying to read the Bible in such a way to make accepting homosexual behavior something that the church can do. You can't make those biblical gymnastics work in such a way that remains true to the word. In every place where Scripture talks about homosexual acts, they're always forbidden. Now, there are other ethical questions that sometimes have a gray area. Like divorce, for example, is forbidden, but also I can show you some verses in the Bible that would, even Jesus gives you an exception, a particular circumstance where divorce might be permissible. So there's some gray area there, but not with homosexuality. There's not a verse in the Bible that is gray or in any way ambiguous. It's clearly always forbidden.